On This Week in Enterprise Tech, China loves UPnP. It's not the post-PC world, and Microsoft has a messaging problem. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 28, recorded February 4th, 2013. Office 365 is cool. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a new mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting, pay for what you use, doesn't require a contract, and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit enterprise.ting.com. That's enterprise.ting.com. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs on RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And as always, I am joined by a phenomenal cast, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise from his hollowed-out volcano in Hawaii. Brian, how are things next to the molten lava, magma, whatever you call it?
Well, other than flying back from Sunnyvale, sitting right in front of Typhoid Mary, who decided to share her cold with everybody in the cheap seats, I've just had a week of antibiotics to try and kill this bug.
Well, you know what they say, sharing is caring. Speaking of caring, we care enough about our chat room that we invite regulars to come back, including Mr. Lou M.M. Lou Maresca from Microsoft. He is our resident expert on all things Surface, Office, and basically, well, our inside track to the world of Microsoft. Lou, how are you up in the northwest? Where exactly are you located?
I'm in Redmond, Washington.
There you go.
The weather is dreary as usual and a little chilly, 50 degrees. But I also, too, have a cold. I don't have such a fantastic story as Brian, but my coworkers were nice enough to give me a cold, too. So,
again, sharing is caring.
Exactly.
Going to the last member of our panel, who I believe he's from the Grumpy Pants Network, so sharing is definitely not caring for him, Mr. Oliver Rist from InfoWorld. Oliver, it's nice to have you back to keep us honest of our opinions and our network knowledge.
Yeah, thanks for creating that grumpy personality for me. I really appreciate it.
And, you it's know, nice to you. Just for you, of course.
I know.
You know, it's special.
Lots of love.
I love
lots
you
of
like
love.
That.
Thank
I love you,
you
like
buddy.
That. That's right. Well, let's get right into it because we've got a absolutely packed show, starting with our Enterprise Byte, which is about this super nasty, scary vulnerability in UPnP. That's Universal Plug and Play. Now, this is a feature that was developed about 12 or so years ago that allowed for the real-time reconfiguration of routers in order to allow communication between the outside world and the devices you may have on your network. Now, if you can think back 12 years ago, we were in a time where we were running out of IPv4 space. And so the savior was NAT, Network Address Translation, which allowed us to take real-world IP addresses like 45. blah, 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 and turn it into something like 192.168. so on and so forth. Well, the problem with that is those 192.168 addresses were not routable. And so you needed some way to reconfigure the router to poke holes in the firewall and allow incoming inbound connections for things like Skype or NetMeeting or any of the other programs and software and services that required a direct communication line. So UPnP was sort of the solution. We had a discovery protocol that allowed the network to find out what was on the network and then to say, hey, what do you need? Where do you need me to poke holes? Let me do it for you and take away the network configuration management. Now, Chibert, let me throw this over to you first. UPnP was one of these things that seemed like a good idea at first, but what, as you know, what was one of the major problems with it?
Well, the biggest problem is a lot of people implemented UPnP without any encryption whatsoever, and they also exposed the SOAP interface. So HP printers are a good example. A lot of Netgear routers, Linksys routers. If you just start up a UPnP client, it'll actually let you go quite a distance into the system. It'll tell you all about the system before it asks you for a password. This goes contradictory to everything in good security. You shouldn't even expose what kind of piece of equipment it is, because that tells you what kind of exploits you can run against it. So UPnP has been a bad idea from the very beginning, and one of the very first things I turn off on any home network. And if you do have to have it on, it should only be turned on from the inside protected side of the network.
Right, right, exactly. So UPnP was designed to live on the LAN side. And even on the LAN side, for these 12 years, IT professionals have been turning it off by default because, as Chibert mentioned, it's just a bad idea to have an unprotected service be able to reconfigure your router. You just don't want to do that. Well, the problem that we found now is H.D. Moore of Metasploit fame completed a 5.5-month scan of all the publicly accessible addresses in IPv4. He used enough computing power to be able to scan every address once a week. And what he found was that there are over 81 million devices that have UPnP turned on the WAN side. Now, think of your home router. We're saying it's bad enough when it's on the LAN side, where the devices behind your network can access the router and reconfigure it. What he found was that there are 81 million devices that can be reconfigured without any password protection from the outside. This is the scary, nasty vulnerability. This is what we're dealing with. He further found that 20% of the 81 million had the SOAP interface exposed, which allowed for remote execution of code. As Chibert mentioned, one of the things you don't want to do is tell an attacker what kind of operating system you're running, because then he knows what kind of exploits he can run. Well, SOAP makes that all the much easier. Furthermore, 73% of these devices used one of four dev kits. So this is kind of lazy engineering. They basically just picked one of the dev kits that was available. Four of the most popular ones had UPnP turned on by default on the WAN side, and they just baked it into their device without any sort of penetration testing, without any sort of verification of whether or not they were secure. Now, here's what really bites. There are many of these devices that if you turn UPnP off on the inside of your network so that, your Xbox Live wouldn't work, it would still stay on the WAN side. It just wouldn't tell you. So you would lose all the advantages of UPnP plus have the vulnerability. Now, I want to go over to you, Lou, because, we had a nice little chat with Steve Gibson last week. Leo Laporte talked about this on Security Now. And he's of the mind that this is Microsoft's fault. I mean, Microsoft really pushed UPnP. The Xbox was the first real device that used UPnP. You needed UPnP enabled. In fact, it would tell you if you tried to start an Xbox Live session, please turn UPnP on your router in order to be able to start the session. Now we're finding out that all these routers with UPnP baked into them are a huge security risk. What was Microsoft thinking when they really pushed UPnP and when they essentially pushed this vulnerability on the world?
So, I mean, if you really think about it, the UPnP built on top of UDP, it's kind of the nature of the protocol to allow kind of that, I wouldn't say vulnerability, but it's just sitting there listening for things to kind of connect to it, right? And it's, the whole datagram type thing. And I think that that's kind of where they were at. They wanted to kind of make things easy. They even built it into things like WCF. A lot of other companies built it into their systems. And so it's really kind of however these software systems kind of interpreted the standard and the protocol, that's kind of how they implemented it. So it's really, to me, the vulnerabilities are not really in the design of the actual standard or the protocol. It's really in the design of who actually implements it. And so like things like Xbox, they implement it's very secure. But, like you said, when they did push it to get that kind of like that ease of use kind of feel to it, then all these other companies jumped in. And of course, these other dev kits jumped in and they tried to implement it. But of course, they implemented it in a way where they kind of left some security holes. So, I mean, it really happens with a lot of protocols. I mean, there's a lot of them out there, especially using SOAP and having, kind of advertising what your service can do, it makes it even worse. So, I mean, if people, same thing happens with a lot of protocols, HTML. I mean, if you don't implement it right, if you don't look for those vulnerabilities, if you don't do smoke testing, it's, you're never going to find them. So I think I don't necessarily would blame it on the company. Of course, I'm slightly biased, but, you know, there are other companies as well that implemented it and they have services that use it. So, you know, maybe it's kind of a conglomerate blame, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Oliver, I want to throw this over to you because this is actually touching on a very foundational issue within security. And that is UPnP actually sounds like a really good idea because you can actually accomplish everything that UPnP does on your own, but you have to know how to poke holes in your firewall. You have to know how to set up the rules so that you can get incoming connections on various ports to the devices that need to get those connections. But you need to know how to do that. UPnP allowed a whole new generation of users to buy something like an Xbox or a smart product, a smart refrigerator, a smart toaster, whatever it's going to be, and have it configure itself and have it poke its holes in the network. Now, what Lou is essentially saying is, look, we pushed the standard, but Microsoft wasn't the one who implemented really bad versions of UPnP. It seems to me that this is indicating that there's always going to be the struggle between making a network easy to use and locking it down. How do we decide how much security is enough and how much convenience is enough?
Well, you're more the security expert than I am, but I understand there is a security feature for UPnP, but nobody uses it.
Exactly.
Right. I don't know what the depth of that is, but if it's there and you don't use it, that's a problem. Number two, I'm not sure you can pin Microsoft for that. I mean, I like nailing Microsoft as much as anybody. But yeah, if you build it into Xbox, it should be implemented on the router the right way. Right. Those are the guys really checking the firewall. And if they should have, you know, if they had a problem with UPnP, I don't think it's beyond those guys to test it. At that point, they should have a dialog box pop up and, hey, are you sure that you want to do this? They should have that at a minimum, right? And possibly, again, I'm not a dev guy, but can't they fix that in firmware if they want to? I can't really pin the device people for it. I mean, not just Microsoft, but anybody, right?
Right.
I would think, logically, security sits at the router level, not the device level. But again, I'm not up on the guts of UPnP.
Actually, Oliver, you bring up another very important point, and that is the idea of dumb appliances. We have now reached a point in our technological history where we look at a router or a wireless access point as a dumb device. We set it up once and we never look at it again. In fact, there are routers out there, many of these 81 million, that were bought 5, 6, 10 years ago and have never, ever been updated. In fact, most of these routers have never had the user go into the user interface except for maybe that first time where they turned on encryption for their wireless and set up NAT traversal. So when we have a device that's been sitting that long without an update, of course we're going to find vulnerabilities for it. We would never think about putting a computer, be it a Windows or a Mac computer, directly connected to the internet without patching it. Cheevert, we have all these devices that are supposed to be dumb devices that are now vulnerable because they are dumb devices. What does this say about the development of devices into the future? Do we have to start building more intelligence into our dumb boxes?
Well, the problem is it's not hard to do. There's an awful lot of SMB SOHO firewalls that actually will automatically download and then send you an email saying, please reboot me. I want to be updated. You know, this is not rocket science. I'd like to actually point the finger at a lot of the developer tools out there. There are not that many embedded systems environments out there. There's been some commercial ones like QNX and so forth. But the problem is it's really hard to write some of these protocols. My favorite example is virtual LANs. There's been a version of a embedded operating system that they've implemented networking pieces where the VLANs have been leaking for almost a decade and it still hasn't been fixed because it's the same toolkits. Come on, guys, this is not rocket science. Self-patching appliances is not that difficult, especially if you've got some sort of web presence where people can download it.
Lou, self-patching is actually not that difficult, but it's something we don't think of because as T-Bert mentioned, when we think of embedded systems, we think of baked security, right? I mean, embedded systems are not supposed to be vulnerable. That's the whole reason why we buy them. So what happens when our embedded systems start being vulnerable, like our laptops, like our desktops?
Yeah. I mean, embedded systems are what they follow what they call a pessimistic network structure. And so they basically close down everything they could possibly close down until they possibly need a service that's going to need that specific protocol. Like, for instance, Android is kind of that way. There's a lot of applications on Android nowadays that will actually take advantage of you plug and play. And so then the protocol, obviously the embedded device then has to open that port. So, I mean, it's really important that these devices then have security systems in place to kind of patch the vulnerabilities that software might necessarily kind of open. And that's just like the rest have been saying, you know, if you have routers that are been sitting around for a really long time and they have these things open, it's really tough for any type of an application to be secure in a way where, you know, unless they are throwing up messages to you saying you have this open, maybe you should close it or maybe you should open it only when you need it, that kind of thing.
Oliver, I want to throw the last question to you, and that is this. This has ramifications for large enterprise networking because most of these 81 million devices that we see with this vulnerability are typically either home office, small to medium business type routers. But those at some point are going to connect to a large enterprise network. So the question becomes, are we baking in a vulnerability into large enterprise networks because we are now at a point where people expect to be able to work from home? I expect to be able to VPN from my system at home in order to get to my office share, whatever it might be, office resources. And if I have a router that's vulnerable, I've now opened a hole into my enterprise network. Is this something that enterprises are looking at? Is this something that enterprises are even considering at this point, that by giving people access to the corporate network from other locations, they may be opening themselves to one of these huge vulnerabilities?
Yeah, it's a huge concern. Windows Server is one of their key marketing pillars is work anywhere off any device, and they're not the only ones. So if I'm an IT pro and I find out about UPnP, I'm either going to disallow home networks, period, or I'm going to tell the user I have to configure your firewall manually, which I don't think most enterprises are going to want to do because it's too expensive. So until that's fixed, I don't know if they can even trust the user to disable. I mean, can you disable UPnP?
That's the problem. You can disable UPnP, but on a lot of these boxes, disabling UPnP on the inside does not disable UPnP on the WAN.
Okay. Well, then I would disallow any home connection until that's fixed. So that blocks all this very cool stuff that you'll find in Windows Server, you'll find in other products that they specifically designed to allow multiple devices and multiple locations and home telecommuters. I mean, this version is very mature in that regard. And you know, if stuff like this is gonna open a hole in the enterprise network, I would just block it.
Yeah, that's actually a great point. I want to hold on to that because we're going to get to that in section two of the episode. But that is a huge question. That is, should enterprise security policy extend to the home if the enterprise user is going to be working remotely? Now, before we head off of this topic, I do want to point out that Steve Gibson from GRC Research, again, one of the hosts of Security Now with Leo Laporte, has actually developed a tool to check your router for this vulnerability. If you go to grc.com and click on the Shields Up link, you'll be able to run the GRC Instant UPnP Exposure Test. And if you click on this, it will actually look at your IP. It will look at your outward-facing WAN port, and it will ping port 1900, UDP, and find out if your address responds to UPnP probes. Now, here at the Brick House, of course, we're secure. We've locked out that port. But if this box turns red and says that it did reply to a UPnP probe, and again, 81 million devices out there will, then you need to turn off UPnP, try it again, and if it still doesn't work, then you're going to have to replace your router. It's that significant. It's that big of an exploit. Now, I want to go from that exploit to one that's, well, a bit more fun. We covered this on Twit yesterday. How many Mac users do we have in the chat room right now? Chibert, you use a Mac, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Do you use Mountain Lion?
Yeah.
Okay. Could you open up any program in your Mac that uses a text box, text editor, Word, whatever it might be. And then you want to do is you want to type in capital F, I-L-E, so file, then colon, and slash, slash, slash. I'm putting it in the chat room right now. Actually, everyone in the chat room is putting it up right now. If you run, if you run a Mac running Mountain Lion, that string right there will crash out whatever piece of software you're using to type it out. People tell me that it's a vulnerability. It's an overrun within Mac's spell check, within Mountain Lion. It won't crash the entire machine, but it will lock up that program. It might take a little while, depending on how fast your machine is, because that will determine how quickly it will evoke the spell checking feature. But my results are pretty dang good. In fact, people in the chat room tell me that they were running a Mac on the lighting system at the Superdome yesterday, and it was file colon slash 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 that killed it. It's a classic buffer overrun. Windows users have been used to it for a long, long time. So, hey, Mac, welcome to the real world. Speaking of the real world, you know what? I want to take some time to talk about one of our sponsors, and that is Ting. Now, you may be asking yourself, what is Ting? The easiest way to think of Ting is it's a no BS cell phone provider. They're a reseller of Sprint services, but with a difference. You see, there are no contracts or early termination fees. It's truly and completely contract-free. There's no bundling or ride-along services. You choose from extra small to extra, extra large service levels for voice, text, and megabytes of data, each of them billed separately. There are no overage charges or penalties. If you use more than you thought, you just pay for what you used. And you also get credits on unused service. If you use less than you thought you would, Ting drops you down to the level that you hit and credits the difference on your next bill. There are also no add-on charges. Voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspot, three-way calling, call forwarding, and other features are all part of the service from the start. Also, you find that, you get unlimited devices on one plan. You can share pooled minutes, messages, and megabytes. And each device on a plan only costs you an extra flat $6 per month. One of the coolest things about Ting is that it has a powerful online account control panel. That means you get to take control of your account, your usage, and your bills so that you can see exactly what you're using and how you need to plan out for the following month. Also, they're one of the only carriers that has a no-hold customer support policy. You can call them at 1-855-TING, FTW, that's Ting for the win, anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and a real person will pick up the phone. I found that they have excellent online support, too. If you go to help.ting.com, you can find active customer support forms, a simple and powerful help ticketing system, video tutorials, and a video startup guide. Now, here's how Ting works. You purchase a mobile device from Ting, which you will receive within 2 to 5 business days. Then you activate your device with Ting and have the option to select a new phone number or port an existing one. Finally, you select the monthly minutes, messages, and megabytes that you think will represent your usage, and Ting will bill you at the beginning of your payment period. Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to visit Ting.com today at enterprise.ting.com. Save money and better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting. Check out their savings calculator and see how much you or your company can save. Twiit viewers also save $25 on their first Ting device when you sign up. So visit enterprise.ting.com today and start saving now. And we thank Ting for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get back to it. We've got more security news. This one is sort of a potpourri of hackery or script kiddiness, depending on how you want to look at this. The first story is about the New York Times. It was recently revealed that the New York Times has been getting hacked for the last 4 months. Now, a lot of the security experts have been pointing the finger at China, and yet the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei has told reporters to arbitrarily assert and to conclude without hard evidence that China participated in such hacking is totally irresponsible. China is also a victim of hacking attacks. Chinese laws clearly forbid hacking, and we hope relevant parties take a responsible attitude on this issue. However, even though they're denying it, as you would expect them to, there's really, really not much doubt where the attacks are coming from. We see where the proxies are coming from. We see the style of attacks. We know that this was a huge concerted botnet attack using several university systems that had been compromised to attack both the New York Times and the end nodes attached to the New York Times. In other words, users who had access to the corporate account. Now, the interesting thing about the story is that they were not after what a typical hack attack might be after in a corporate attack. They were not looking for credit cards. They were not looking for customer account information. They were looking for specific data about the sources of a story that the New York Times had on Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao. Cheever, looking at something like this, is this going to be par for the course? I mean, China seems to do this better than any other country right now. They have a very developed cyber warfare capability, cyber fighting capability, and they can get it done. It's what are we looking at here?
Well, we're looking at an organization that probably doesn't know what the left hand is doing from the right hand. You know, just because, you know, a state mouthpiece says, oh, this is illegal and so forth, I'll just bet you that there's probably some folks in a dark room, you know, smoking black Chinese cigarettes and just going, ah, ha, ha, we're going to go and get them. Well, it's happened over and over again. I was head of network security for the Asian Development Bank meeting in Honolulu. And even back in those days, we were getting an insane amount of attacks. And when I started trying to geolocate those IP addresses, they almost all came from mainland China, almost exclusively from what are probably compromised machines at Chinese universities. It's just a different attitude. Even the kids from mainland China that come to the University of Hawaii, a lot of times I have to sit them down and say, no, you do not share passwords. No, you don't open everything up. No, you have to implement some sort of security and virus checker. We do not want you sharing our bandwidth with the rest of the world. It's a whole mindset that's different.
Right, right. Lou, what about this? I mean, it's obvious that, look, China's not the only government doing this. They're just the government that seems to be doing it most successfully. Is this a war-fighting capability that we're going to have to start seeing from all the developed nations? Are you going to have a cyber unit that can target specific institutions, even private institutions within an enemy government?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's amazing because, you know, especially China, India, all these countries that have a lot more people than we do, they're obviously going to be, you know, people targeting specific systems in different countries. It's going to look very strange, and it's going to possibly even look like warfare in that sense. But, you know, it's the nature of evolution from a system standpoint. I mean, everyone's getting online, everyone's getting more devices now. And as we move forward, you know, more and more security is going to have to come up, whether it be a personal security, whether it be, you know, people just watching data come across the line. I mean, some of those things need to be implemented. And, you know, and that's just kind of the nature of evolution of technology.
Yeah. Oliver, I want to toss this to you with a little addition to the story, and that is that the Wall Street Journal, right after the New York Times came out and said that they had been getting hacked for the last 4 months, the Wall Street Journal came out and said, look, we've been getting hacked for the last couple of years. And it was the same thing. You had hackers who were not after customer information. They were after sources for stories that the Wall Street Journal had run, specifically stories about Chinese manufacturing practices. So, again, you know, it seems pretty obvious who was after the information, but the Chinese seem to be getting it done.
Well, I don't know if you read it, but Discovery Channel did a story on their website, and they didn't really source how they knew this, but according to them, it was written by a security expert or a chief security officer. He says when he analyzes it, it does not look like it's coming from the Chinese government. It looks like it's coming from individual hackers who are just out for the, you know, like our hackers, they're out for the glory. So if they're crashing sites like WSG or they're hacking them, according to this guy, that's not coordinated by the Chinese government. It's just independent folks looking, you know, doing it for the fun of it. So I'm assuming he's analyzing all the stuff that we're analyzing as far as source IPs and that kind of thing. But I don't think it's a done issue. And I don't think we should respond as though it's the Chinese government until we really know.
I was hoping that a member of the panel would bring that up. Cheever, let me go back to you with this, because it is really easy to spoof your origin. I mean, we all know that. Just because I have an IP address doesn't mean I'm coming from a particular country. So when I'm looking at all this data and I'm looking at all these experts saying, look, the type of attack seems to suggest the Chinese, the target seems to suggest the Chinese, and the organization seems to suggest the Chinese government, As Oliver mentioned, that doesn't necessarily mean that's the case, right?
Well, of course not. It's bad guy of the month type of thing. It rotates around the world. You know, my firewalls actually have entire countries blocked out because it's so prevalent. There's so little network security in some South American countries. But that doesn't mean it's being done by the government. There's a lot of people out there, especially, you know, when we first started getting a lot of the Russian republics coming online, they were so pissed off that America had all the resources and, oh, it's poor us, and they decided to take it out on us. This is not something that a government doing. This is something that a person that feels slighted by the world, someone that feels entitled to something better, someone that has the ego that wants to go and lash out at the world. Those are the people that are dangerous because they have way too much time on their hands.
All right. Now, the reason why I wanted to bring up this segment after the first segment was because, well, if you read some of the rumor reports about the attacks on the New York Times and the Wall Street Journals, they suggested that, yes, there was a wholesale botnet attack of the corporate systems, but far, far, far more successful were attacks on remote nodes. So we're talking about botnets that were able to compromise networks of, say, New York Times workers who were working from home or Wall Street Journal executives who were VPNing in from a remote office. Those offices and those homes were much less hardened than a corporate network. And yet, once they were able to get behind the small office firewall, they were able to get into the corporate network with relatively little trouble. It strikes me that you combine this with, say, the report about 81 million devices having UPnP enabled on the WAN port. Well, we've got a major problem with enterprise security policy. Chibert, let me throw this to you first, because you've dealt with some of the greatest firewalls that the industry has to offer from all the major manufacturers. They're all designed to keep out attacks, but to allow in remote branches. What kind of protection do you have from a remote branch coming into your corporate network?
Actually, I actually ran a pretty big firewall test for InfoWorld. I must be close to 4 or 5 years ago now. The reality is it is not difficult to do to have VPNs that are actually treated as separate zones. So the test scenario I had is I actually had a regional headquarters with a good-sized firewall, and I had 2,000 branch offices all VPNing in. Each branch office had 20 people behind it. So this might be Panda Foods or Ace Hardware or something like that. And each VPN was considered a different zone, and I could apply different rules to it. So the deep packet inspection would be able to look at it even though it was coming over a trusted link. The whole point here was trust but inspect. And it seemed to work pretty well. We actually ran the entire cert vulnerability catalog, both internal and external to the firewalls, both forward and backwards, as if someone brought an infected laptop in. And some of the firewalls actually did very, very well.
Oliver, I want to throw this over to you. So Chibert is essentially saying, look, it's possible to do this, and we can set up our firewalls so that a remote connection coming in has an extra level of scrutiny. It's separated from the main network. However, tell me about this scenario. If I have a corporate officer who is having trouble accessing the data that he wants to access from home, even though he shouldn't be able to because it's not trusted, because it's coming in from a remote location. How many IT people do you know who are willing to stand up to say a CTO and say, I'm sorry, sir, I can't give you access to that. It's not corporate policy.
The ones I know are all willing to do that. They have to. This was a really funny story. I forget for which dev house, but there was a 45, 48-year-old dev guy who decided to hire a Chinese guy to do his work for him for X percent of his annual salary. And he got caught after, 8 months to a year by the security office suddenly noticing that he was getting a connection from China that was sending this guy's work. So while I think security officers would necessarily stand up to a CEO or implement a policy that would just be, corporate-wide and get his approval first, I don't think a lot of them do it.
Lou, let me go over to you as our man at Microsoft. Your campus deals with remote workers a lot. What kind of security procedures do you have in place to make sure that someone coming in from a remote location isn't going to compromise the corporate network?
So that's a good question. So one of the things that we do is we have RT does very specific scans of your machine before you even have the option to install VPN. And so they not only scan your machine, they scan your network, they scan your public IP, they scan pretty much just about everything. And then what happens is we get these little bulletins that pop up in the operating system that say, you have vulnerabilities, here's how to fix them. And then we actually go through and apply service packs and packs. We have to go and patch holes in the network, stuff like that, before we even have any access to the VPN over the network. So they're very, very careful when it comes to that. Because if you think about it, we are their weakest link. Some of us have access to very specific secret data that anybody kind of attacked our homes and we were over VPN, that would be something that they could leak out. So they're very, very particular about that. And not only that, we have to use our smart cards to authenticate ourselves as well. It's all encrypted. So they're very, very particular. And you can't use things like, for instance, I have a Mac. I do have OS X. I can't access the network from my Mac because they don't have VPN capabilities on the Mac using their specific software. So we have to go through using kind of our Windows machines for now.
Okay. All right. So you do have a policy. I mean, you have a specific procedure that you have to follow in order to be able to access something remotely.
Yep. Yeah. We have to download the tool first, and then we obviously have to follow the policy as well. Sure.
All right. I want to mutate this discussion a little bit, get into Twitter. So Twitter was hacked along with the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. They lost the information for about 250,000 users. But here's a little sort of a sunny side of this. The passwords were salted and hashed. So even though that a hacker may be able to get the username and password and username and email address, the password is a little harder to come by. They have done things the right way in informing their users that their accounts may have been compromised. They've been sending out emails. I did not get one. But I want to ask the group about this. This was something that was brought up in tech news today, this morning. And that is, whenever we hear about these breaches, they seem to come out in groups. There was the theory floated that once one company comes out, other companies with breaches like to sort of use that opportunity to get information about the breach into the public. But it does seem odd that there's sort of a rule of threes whenever we're talking about corporate information breaches. Open question to the panel. Why do you think that is?
Well, if it's me, I mean, I would put it out right then, because you'd think the backlash would be a little mitigated. You're just one of many. That would be my strategy. I don't know if that would actually work.
Well, I think in Twitter's case, it definitely works, because they actually get to show that they were doing things the right way. By keeping the passwords salted and hashed, they're saying, look, we're not Sony. We didn't keep the passwords right next to the usernames in clear text. We actually took steps to make sure that when we're compromised, not if, but when we're compromised, we have a way to respond in a timely fashion and possibly get the information to the user before the attackers are able to utilize that username and password.
But how many users are actually going to understand that or even read that?
That's true. Now, but the way that Twitter did it was, if you tried to log in and you had one of the compromised accounts, it would actually ask you to change your password. Now, they were a little bit under fire for not expiring the tokens that were attached to the username and password. But again, I think it's a better example of a company doing things the right way rather than either sitting on it or kind of just hoping that no one would notice. Chibert, what is your general take on the way that companies tell the world about the breaches within their internal security?
Oh, man, sweeping it under the rug is always going to come back to bite you. But I agree with Oliver. You know, releasing your dirty laundry around the time someone else releases some dirty laundry kind of makes you feel not quite so alone. There's nothing quite as bad as standing alone in the media with no one sharing the spotlight. So that's my spin on it, too.
All right, I think we've spent enough time on security. I do want to move on, but before we do, I want to have a talk, just you and me. Are you starting your own business? Are you starting your own campus? Are you starting a brand new venture that, well, you need to connect to the outside world? If so, you know, you may want to take a couple of notes from how we did the Brick House. You see, when Leo built the Brick House, he decided that he wanted to have as much in the cloud as possible. Our show notes are in the cloud. Our email is in the cloud. Every service that we could have in the cloud, we moved to the cloud. So when Russell, our IT guy, told Leo that we could put our phone system in the cloud, well, it was a no-brainer. We decided that we wanted to use RingCentral because it meant a no-muss, no-fuss, no-hassle phone system, a full-featured PBX without PBX hardware. There is no hardware to install or maintain, no box that goes down into the basement, no excessive rat's nest of wires that need to snake their way up. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling. Our producers can get their voicemail and their emails, and we can get our fax messages right on our smartphones. Now, RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing, as low as $20 per user per month. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you can get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Again, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT to find out what RingCentral can do for you. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to the last bit of the show, and that is the post-PC world. Now, before you start groaning, because I know you are, because we've heard this all before, there are actually some interesting numbers out of the IDC to support the fact that we are definitely on the way to the post-PC world. We have an article here from GigaOM that talks about how, for the first time, tablets accounted for more than half of the PC shipments. We have 52.5 million tablets shipped in quarter four 2012 compared to 89.8 million PCs. Now, again, we're still selling a buttload of PCs. That's a technical term, buttload. But the fact that we're up to 52.5 million tablets means that there's a definite switch, a flip in what people expect out of the devices that they use to access networks, access information. Furthermore, we've got IDC breaking down the types of mobile devices that are purchased. So when we look at those 52.5 million tablets, which is a 75.3% growth year over year, we see the iPad at a 43.6% share with 22.9 million units sold. We have Samsung with a 15.1% share with 7.9 million units sold. We have Amazon at 11.5% share with 6 million units sold, and Asus with the fourth spot with 3.1 million units for 1.9% of the market. Now, my question to the panelists would be, is this the turning point? I mean, have we finally seen that point at which we can say, every year from now on, we're going to see more and more mobile devices, be it tablets or mobile phones, and fewer desktops? Let me start off with you, Oliver, since you always seem to get the last spot.
No, I don't believe that at all. I think tablets are great. I own two of them. I do zero work on them. And I think the PC is actually graduating back toward a work machine rather than a game machine, right? I mean, most people are graduating to console-based games, which is a different box. I use my computer for work, period. I never use my iPad for work, and I don't foresee a day when I will. It's just, it's not tough enough. It's not big enough. It's not strong enough. I would never trust it. I haven't looked at the iOS operating system. I know it's going to get trashed sooner or later. Maybe I'm old fashioned. I'm an old guy, but I'm sticking to a PC, period.
Oliver, I have never loved you as much as I love you right now. I had to hear someone finally say that. Thank you so very much. Lou, let me go to you. That's an interesting point of view, which is, look, the desktop's not going away. In fact, if you look at the numbers, it sounds like the tablets are really starting to make up the difference. But that's assuming that people are replacing their desktops and their laptops with tablets. That's not really what the numbers are saying, right? People are getting tablets to complement their new laptop or their new desktop.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think one of the things that it's all the point of view of the user. I mean, some people who are like Oliver said, you know, gamers are not going to go unless they're getting these massive laptops that are, you know, that have these huge graphics cards in them. But if you have a home user, like for instance, for me, when I do work from home, using a Surface Pro or an Elite Pad or any of these devices and using things like Azure, where I can just spin up some machines and drop some code on them. I mean, that's a huge productivity tool for me. It's really dependent on the user. Like for instance, users who buy iPads, some of them are home users that like to game and so on and so forth. So maybe an iPad's kind of good for them because it's a casual gamer. But, you know, users who want to build things and distribute things, you know, sometimes, having a really good productivity tablet, like, a pro device, like a Windows 8 Pro device or something like that, that they can get their normal software on, development tools or whatever, it makes it more plausible for them. I mean, I built a machine at home that has, 12 cores so I could get Hyper-V on it and make some VMs. And now that I find that, I'm using a tablet and I'm using I'm using Azure, I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to spend the money and do it. So, I kind of have a different view on it. I think it's kind of going that way. And it's cost less as well.
Yeah. Chibert, we had an interesting viewpoint on Twit yesterday. And that is when we see the increase in sales of phones and tablets in relation to desktops, we're not really seeing a shift from one platform to another, but really what we're seeing is a shift of where we expect our data to live. In the old PC world, you always expected your data to live on your computer, on your laptop, and on your desktop. We're getting much, much more used to our data now living in the cloud, in either the public or the private cloud, somewhere other than on the machine that I'm using. And so that makes tablets actually usable. If I can access the same data on my tablet than I access on my laptop, then it makes it a good complement rather than a toy. Now, in your work, working with ThinLinks, you're specifically working with a company that's really trying to get people used to accessing not just data, but resources in the cloud. What would you say is your take on this number spread? Again, hearing from Lou and hearing from Oliver and from myself that it doesn't mean the end of the PC. What does it mean for a company like ThinLinks, which is selling what looks like a post-PC product?
A lot of this is, I still use an iPad an awful lot. And I've got the ThinLinks Remote FX client on it so that I can slave a virtual machine in the cloud, public or private. But what I am seeing is that a lot of people are now willing to carry a tablet. I see people with tablets at restaurants. I see people with tablets in parks. I see people with tablets at movie theaters. So hopefully they're not using it during the movie. But this is not something we're ever going to see with a laptop. People aren't going to haul out a laptop at a restaurant for the most part. Microsoft Campus, probably different. But people are using the tablets as an extension. They want to be able to go and still get access to their data. They want to be able to get access and stay connected to the corporation or to other people. The cloud is extending things. It's great. We can actually do a lot more stuff, and we can do a lot of stuff elsewhere. We're not being so much tied to the desk. We're not being tied to the office. I think this might start a pretty interesting revolution as more and more people start getting into things like hot desking. Why have a permanent desk anymore? Just grab the first open desk and log into the cloud. Might be interesting.
Interesting indeed. And let's get to some of the real interesting stuff. The reason why we have Lou MM on, and that is to talk all about the Surface RT, Surface Pro. Lou, okay, so let me throw a couple of numbers at you. We're seeing right now that the Surface RT sales, let's say they haven't been great. The general consensus is you're looking at 1.25 million units that were sold into the channel, maybe half of those that were sold out of the channel. You're seeing an unusually high return rate and no noticeable move to restock the channel before the Tet holiday. So we've got Tet coming up at the end of February. All the manufacturers who needed to push out product got their orders in January because they know that for about a month, Asia is going to shut down. The factories will not be running. So what does this say about the RT and its sales prospects?
So I think the way that people are receiving the RT is more like, for instance, how everyone kind of received the iPad. I mean, it's kind of an environment where you develop an app, like, for instance, a WinRT app that it's very specific to that specific device, and you can't kind of go out of the spectrum for that. And so, you know, there's a very limited set of software out there. In fact, they do a lot of pushing to kind of evangelize and get people to build apps because they want the apps to be there because it is a very good platform to build them on. It's very secure and it's very useful. And I think that's kind of the problem is people are receiving it and saying, you know, I have this great device. In fact, my son loves it, using it even more than the iPad. But he finds that, you know, there's not enough, children's games or there's not enough education stuff on it. And so when they receive that and they figure that out and they look over to the iPad and they see, you know, 10 times, 100 times more apps, and they kind of receive it wrong. And they say, you know what, I'd rather have an iPad. So that's kind of my point of view on it. I think that there's other devices that are just fantastic devices that are actually better than the iPad, thinner than even the Surface RT, like the Asus machines that have battery lives that are well above 12 hours, 13 hours. So I just wish that they could just get some more software out there and people would, you know, jump on it. But I think that's where the Surface Pro is going to come in is you know, they're going to see that there's now millions, almost billions of apps that they can run on the Surface device and still get pretty good battery life and be super productive. So I think that that's we're going to kind of see more of those devices coming out in the forefront.
Sorry, I was sharpening my teeth there. Let's talk about the Surface Pro, because that's really what we want to talk about, right? So it's coming out. We've got the announcement. We've got the release. We know more or less the price points. And the big talk right now is that the 64-gigabyte version of the Surface Pro will only have 23.2 gigabytes of usable storage. And that's because half of the space is taken up by the operating system. Then you have a large chunk taken up by applications or by the recovery partition. Lou, what's going on?
Well, if you think about it, Windows is a pretty powerful operating system. If you think about it from the 64-bit standpoint, when you have a 64-bit operating system, you not only have all of the 64-bit files and binaries, but you also have all the 32-bit binaries as well, because you need to be able to run 32-bit applications on there. So that almost doubles the size of the operating system. And then when you're actually trying to refresh that operating system from, you know, via the firmware, then you have doubled the space there as well. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that they've been trying to do to kind of get around that, compressions and so on and so forth, but it's super hard to do. So I can kind of see people's frustrations because, you know, they buy this thing thinking they're going to have 128 and they find, oh, the operating system, you know, takes this much and then, you know, and then I have to, in order for me to kind of refresh the operating system later on, it takes this much. So it makes sense that they're frustrated, which is why they did put out steps to help you kind of offload
right.
The refresh to a separate device. But, you know, hopefully those steps will get a little easier over time to help normal consumers do it.
Yeah,
I can see the frustration.
So to be fair to Microsoft, you can offload that recovery partition to a USB bootable disk.
Yep.
And also, the Surface does have a SD card slot. It does have USB, so you can have external storage. But here's I think, the point, and that is by using the same name, so Surface RT, Surface Pro, people expected it to be like a tablet. If people just thought this was a Windows 8 notebook that happened not to have a keyboard, I don't think there would not have been an eye bat it. There would not have been one single person who would have said, oh, this is an outrage. People would have said, oh, yeah, it's like a laptop. And in a laptop, you have a 500-gigabyte hard drive, and some of it's going to be taken up by all the software.
No, I completely agree. Yeah. Yep.
Let me go to Oliver. Oliver, it seems like Microsoft has a messaging problem, which is weird because this is their brand-new $1.6 billion campaign for the Surface for Windows 8. And it seems like they're now doing themselves a disservice by having the Surface Pro be called another tablet rather than being called a Windows 8 laptop.
Microsoft have a messaging problem? No, that's never happened before. Yeah, I'd have to agree. I don't know how successful that's going to be. Even users who get that are kind of scratching their heads, right? It's a different CPU. Even Microsoft says it's not as strong as a full-on laptop, even an ultra portable. So no keyboard, really slim. Why, you know, it's a little cheaper. It's, and still, in my opinion, too expensive. Why do I buy that? I don't, you know, it's a toy, right? It's a geek toy. And the more you put features out or messages out, like, yeah, you can offload this to blah, blah, home users are just going to drop it, right? And as a corporate device, I don't see it today. I mean, in typical Microsoft fashion, you know, this first rev sucks. So I think in the future, you know, second rev, third rev, it'll mature, and I think they'll add some of the right features, and certainly software support will increase. So talk to me again in a year and a half.
Chiba, let me throw this over to you, because I think in the tech press, we get a little jaded. Engineers and geeks, we kind of know the difference between the Surface RT and the Surface Pro and a Windows 8 notebook and a laptop. But someone walking into, let's say, a Microsoft store and seeing a Windows 8 notebook, seeing the Surface Pro, seeing the Surface RT, do they really know the difference? I mean, the interface looks the same.
This is all a problem. There's too many. It's so alike. You know, when you and I walked through the Microsoft store in Tyson's Corner, I started looking and go, oh, which Asus is that? Or which Acer is that? They're all looking the same. Everybody's copying each other. So it's really hard to tell now. The unfortunate thing is that consumers are going to have to really take a good hard look and compare side by side, look at the spec sheets. And unfortunately, the Surface Pro, even though I think it's a great design and I'm thinking I might actually plunk down some bucks for it, it's a question of this is the quarter pounder, but it's not a quarter pounder after you cook it.
You know what? Burger analogies, I understand quite well. So I'm so down with that. And now I'm hungry. I do want to move on because we're getting down a rat hole. And that is Office 365. So I'm going to give this over to Lou. Lou, tell us, what's new with Office 365?
So, I mean, one of the great things about Office 365 is you can, you know, for people who, you know, want to have the power of Office on their machine, they can do it for just $9 a month. I think it's even cheaper for students. And it gives you access to things like the complete spectrum of Office, OneNote, Publisher, Outlook, all that stuff. And also it gives you that kind of perpetual upgrade, which is kind of neat because anytime Microsoft puts out a new version of Office, you immediately have the option to upgrade to it. So it's kind of that neat thing, as well as you can have it up to 5 PCs on your machine, in your house, in your household. So on one subscription. So I think that's kind of a unique thing that they've been able to do, as well as the enterprise level thing as well. They've kind of sectioned off and allowed you to have different tiers of different things to buy. So like, for instance, if you wanted Exchange or if you just wanted mail accounts, they could do that. If you wanted to have, you know, mail accounts plus Office support or SharePoint support, or there's very easy ways to basically customize and a la carte the system, which is making it more powerful for that user perspective. So I think they're definitely going in the right direction, especially for people who want to have low startup costs and low hard drive fees.
All right, so we've got the official word now. Let me throw this to Oliver and to Chibert. So Office 365 sounds interesting. So you pay a monthly subscription, $9 a month forever, whatever it's going to be, but for that money, you get the most up-to-date software at all times. And you get software that you can install in 5 different machines. And you get software that's accessible on all the different devices that you're going to use it on. We talked about that, how we're moving into a generation that expects to get the same glass no matter what device I'm using. My Surface RT, my Surface Pro, my Win 8 notebook, my tablet, my phone. But here's my big thing, and we talked about this when we were talking about virtualization and we were talking about virtual network infrastructure. What happens when I lose my internet access? This seems to be something that everyone who's big into cloud, big into cloud services, seems to try to gloss over because there's no really good answer for it. In fact, we have a story here about how there was an outage not too long ago. In fact, just last Friday, just for 2 hours from Tech Radar here, talking about how Office 365 went down. People were unable to access their accounts. Microsoft explained it away as a routine maintenance problem. But it seems to me that if I'm going to trust my services to the cloud, I don't accept routine maintenance. You can't have routine maintenance. Office 365 has to be up 365. Am I wrong here, Chibert?
Oh, no, that's totally right. You know, when you're depending on a cloud service, you know, we really need to start talking about a concept called nonstop. There's things called load balancing. So you can take certain servers down, do upgrades and patches and so forth, and shift the load to other servers. That's what cloud computing is really all about, being able to dynamically change according to load and needs. So yeah, that's kind of lame. If you're going to depend on Office 365 instead of putting the thick clients onto your machines, then you want it up and running. So you want, you're going to spend the extra money on the stable internet. You're going to spend a little bit more money for the faster internet. It just would be nice if the back end was just as reliable.
Yeah. Oliver, this is it's actually a big issue here, because for me, if I lose my Office 365 for a couple hours, I'm really not put out. I mean, I've got local copies of Office. I can do what I need to do. But if I'm running an enterprise on Office 365 across thousands of seats and I lose it for half an hour, that's absolutely unacceptable, right?
No. I disagree with most of this. Number one, I love Office 365. I'm running it right this second. From a business side, I think Microsoft is doing it wrong. They're pitching it only to enterprises, which is weird. I mean, they're a very small SMB messaging platform, which is strange, because I'll bet you, you know, 90% of the customers are going to be small businesses, because the enterprises, they are stuck with regulatory compliance issues. And you know those guys aren't going to analyze Office 365 for a year, 2 years, whatever. So those guys are going to be stuck on local anyway. And as far as Office 365 is concerned, you have the option, especially from a business side, you can use something called Click to Run to combine cloud apps with local apps, which is something Microsoft is not messaging very well, because it makes them a cloud pioneer, right? I still haven't found any other cloud service that does that. Right, that's a pioneering move. You're basically using the cloud as middleware. As far as storage goes, yes, I guess if your internet connection goes down, you have local copies of the apps. You're hosed if you can't get to your data. However, if I'm a small business, I still use tape backup, boys. I mean, I use USB backup. I use local backup. I would never just dump everything that I have in the cloud and figure that I can keep it there. Right, so I use my cell phone. I call up. I say, hey, I can't get this file because Azure's down for whatever reason. Can you email it to me? And that's a quick workaround, right? It's not sexy, but it's certainly usable. And for the price point of O365, I'd consider it if I were doing a startup.
Nice. Okay, so Lou, let me go back to you with this, because we've also got a story here from Wired about how Microsoft is, they're in a mad dash to build up server capabilities. And the story talks about how they're using traditional data centers. So, you know, actual create a foundation, pour the concrete, build up a data center. And they've also got these things called IT packs, the sort of data center pods that can have as many as 2,500 servers per tractor trailer loadable thing that they can drop in and boost the server capabilities in just a moment, in just an instant. Is this something that we're going to see more and more as they find out where the demand is going to be for Office 365? And let me add a question on top of that, taking from Oliver's very, very nice expose on Office 365. And that is, why isn't Microsoft telling everyone about, like, say, the option to run locally, the option to use Azure as a middleman?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not going to pretend to know what marketing thinks and what they attempt to do. There's sometimes, you know, things that I agree with and things that I don't agree with. Oliver makes an awesome point. I mean, there's a lot of apps at Microsoft, CRM being one of them, that when we build cloud-based offerings, we also build in capabilities to go offline. I mean, that's just one of the things that we put in there from the forefront. So it'd be nice to actually have messaging for that. It's very important, I think. But I think another thing is with these IT packs, I mean, it's going to be very important, especially around when you know there's a lot more traffic happening in one part of the world, part of the country. It's going to be important to be able to offer specific pieces. You know, Azure's a perfect example. So if you have more traffic because people are starting to utilize, some kind of a service, like maybe, let's say, Netflix or something more often on the East Coast at a specific point in time, they're going to have that server support. So I think there's going to be more and more of these pop-up type network or data centers coming up all over the world.
All right.
I got one additional point there. Sorry. I just got back from a meeting with a consultant who they still specialize in AWS, and he told me something I didn't know, and it's probably true for Azure. If this is one of the reasons you have service outages, customers don't realize apparently have availability zones where, you know, the Northeast is one, Southeast is one. If you're not reading the agreement or the description, they're going to dump your stuff wherever you are. So if those servers go down, you're hosed. You're not, weirdly, you're not going to automatically get multiple data center support. So there's still room for consulting intelligence for most customers, especially SMBs. They're just going to click on it and go. If you don't want a service outage, you can architect for it. Just most people don't.
All right. I do want to say that we had a great discussion about Office 365 on Windows Weekly last week. So if you go to twit.tv/ is it just WW or Windows Weekly?
Good question. I don't know.
Just go to Windows Weekly last week. Download that episode. They've got a great conversation on Office 365, way more than we could ever do. But I also want to mention that in the chat room, TV's Egon sent us the picture that makes Oliver famous, talking about Oliver being excited about Office 365. Oliver, welcome to the chat realm.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for that. That's very nice of you to put that one out.
They love you. They really, yeah, really love you.
I can tell, though I'm not in it right now, so I'm missing it. But what do they have a question about? I am extremely excited about Office 365. I love it. And you, by the way, you haven't talked about the server half. All you talk about is the client half, which is great for, you know, home users and whatever. But you should look at the server half. You get discounted server apps that you can run out there or run locally, and again run in combination. That's super sexy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll have to save that conversation for another day, because unfortunately we've reached the end of another episode of TWiET. I do want to thank all my panelists, starting with Chibert. Chibert, what's going on in Hawaii with the Geek in Paradise? What do you want our listeners to know about?
Thin links. We're getting really close to being able to ship out our review units. And just got to go and finish all the packaging and the manuals now.
Right. So if you've ever wanted to play with thin client infrastructure, thin links is definitely one of the vendors you have to check out.
Want one.
Wah, 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 wah. Lou M.M. in Microsoft, thank you for coming back onto the show. I did tell you there was going to be a bit more abuse. I hope we weren't that mean, thanks for coming on. What projects are you working on?
Still working on the CRM project, and we're working real hard to come out with some releases this year. And look out for some things coming out pretty soon. And also look out for some things coming out for me as well. I'm doing some things on the side. Microsoft gives us this great moonlighting policy that we can build some things on the side. So I'll be posting those soon.
Yeah. Stay in the chat room. You'll be able to see Lou M.M. pretty much every single day. Now to Oliver, I have to say personally, it's always great to have Oliver on the show. He really does keep us honest. He speaks his mind, and he is a journalist of true, true integrity. Oliver, thank you very much for coming on. What do you want our listeners to know about?
Well, number one, I think all your guys keep you honest. Yeah, I'm about to do a review of Thin Links, and I think I'm going to trash it, because I'm just kidding. I just submitted my Windows Server Essentials review to InfoWorld, and I'm going to do an Office 365. They want me to go and look at that. And I guess by my tone of voice, you can predict what I'm going to say. But I'll do some different testing, and maybe I'll find a reason not to like parts of it. But so far, I'm using it on a day-to-day basis. Both have server and client. I like it.
No, it's important enough that we should have you back on the show once you're done with that, once you can actually talk about it publicly. And just take us through the review, take us through your methodology, take us through all the different metrics that you think are going to matter to enterprise and small business. Because, you know, we like to mess with Microsoft a lot, but Office 365 truly is a revolutionary product for the enterprise. Also, I do want to thank everyone for watching us live, but in case you're watching this on a download, did you know that we do this live? That's right. We record live every Monday. It's at noon Pacific time at live.twit.tv. And while you're watching us live, you can jump into the chat room at irc.twit.tv. You'll notice through my episodes that I often call upon chat room, upon the fine citizens of our chat realm, to give us answers, to give us comments, and yes, to give us clues about what's next in the enterprise world. Come join us and be part of that wonderful experiment called the chat. Also, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or drop by twit.tv/twiet to find out all the different ways you can have our episodes automatically delivered to your device of choice. You want Android? Sure. iPod? Yes. iPad? Of course. Even to your Zune, we will deliver it each and every single week. You can get your goodness with the hotness on a regular. That's right. Finally, please stop by the Twiat YouTube page at youtube.com/Twiat. It's the new way to subscribe to our show, and that community will allow us to do things like Google Hangouts as we grow and as we will increase our subscriber base. Also, I'd like you to please, right now, jump over to Twitter. Jump on to twitter.com/PadreSJ to follow the Digital Jesuit. Find out what I'm doing each day. Find out what each episode's going to be about and to suggest topics for future episodes. In fact, many of the episodes we've had so far in our 28 up to this point have been taken straight from the tweets of Chat Realm. We love you. We thank you. Drop on by. Finally, thanks to everyone here at the Brick House who made this possible, to Jason Howell, our fantastic TD who keeps us on track, to Karsten, my super producer, to Leo, Lisa, and Sarah, who's sitting over there, and she's staring at me with this weird cat-like look. I love it. I'm Father Robert Ballister, and remember, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.